When Jimmy Carter became president of the United States, he took the family-owned peanut farm and business in Plains, Georgia, and turned it over to a blind trust, managing not only that business but also the other assets of his branch of the Carter family. The press has recently reported that when he returned to Plains, Georgia in 1981, he found that the business was in something of a disarray, that where once there had been profits, instead there were debts and there were extreme difficulties that required a great deal of the time and energy of this former president. You can be sure that the man who, for that 4 years, was in the White House held strictly accountable those managers of the blind trust who had been his representative in things that he had no direct knowledge or control over during those 4 years. Accountability, it's an expectation, it's a principle that extends to our lives as well, us ordinary people. If, for example, I borrow your car this next week and return it 3 days later, you kind of expect that I will return it with four fenders and doors and glass and the basic things with which it left. Or if I were to have you become the manager of my assets that I have accumulated thus far in life, I would expect that upon return of those assets to me, I would hold you accountable, and you would expect that I would hold you accountable for that which you have done as my representative. None of which is to say that if I return your car, that it has to be perfect and scratch-free, as long as I can explain why I did what I did, nor do I necessarily expect that you will have a 200% per year return on that which you manage in my behalf. It's not saying what the results will be, but it is saying that there must be accountability for that which is managed in someone else's place. This principle is not just for cars and for trusts, it's also for the kingdom of heaven as well. For when Jesus Christ is the ruling monarch of our lives, which we as Christians claim him to be, then we understand that God calls us to accountability. That is precisely the point of the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, verses 14 to 30, a section of scripture to which I invite you for reading this morning. It is a famous parable and a somewhat complex parable, one that I think is particularly susceptible to misinterpretation and to misapplication. It was Jesus who said that it will be as when a man going on a journey called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid the master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also who had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not winnow. So I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here is what is yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sowed and gather where I have not winnowed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him, and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have abundance, but from him who has not even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. There men will weep and gnash their teeth.
I think with this parable of Matthew 25 comes a good time to repeat and to reinforce what is the basic rule of parable interpretation. We have on Sunday mornings in 1987 taken a look at now 21 parables. In each of them, we have sought to apply this rule, a rule that perhaps from last January has been forgotten. The simple rule that parables make a single point by comparison. A single point, and they do it by comparison. The single point of this parable is not about investing in the stock market. And the single point in this parable is not about going to heaven or going to hell. And the single point in this parable is not about an endorsement of capitalism. The single point of the parable of the talents in Matthew 25 is that God calls us to accountability. Now, in understanding that single point which Jesus here seeks to make, we need to begin by understanding that there is an accountability, not just for the servants, but for us as citizens of the kingdom of heaven, for our actions. And the principle is that what we do with what we have is more important than what we actually have. In the parable, before this wealthy master left on his long journey, he summoned three of his servants to come and stand before him. I assume that he was a very, very wealthy and powerful man. I assume, from some hints that are given actually in the parable, that he had far more money and he had far more servants. But he selected these three because he knew them well. He knew their abilities, and he entrusted to them talents. Now, not talents in the sense of whether someone can play the piano or draw a picture, although it's interesting that those who study the etymology of words, the history of words, think that in all probability, our use of the word talent came from the popularity of this parable. And although that's never what the parable referred to, that's where we have gotten the word in our society. In those days, talent meant something quite different. You might think from reading the parable that it referred to a unit of money, as in other parables we've learned about drachma and denarii. But that's not the case either. It wasn't a monetary unit, it was a unit of weight. However, we're not told here what's being weighed. The three typical choices were copper, silver, and gold. If it was copper, by comparison, it wasn't very much money. If it was gold, a talent of gold would have been worth an exorbitant amount of money. Chances are it was silver. That would be the most common understanding that people would have had in those days of Jesus referring to a talent as a weight of measuring out in a monetary unit. If that be the case, we try to translate that into our money today, we'd probably be able to figure out that that much gold will be worth about $2,000 per talent. So he brings these three servants in front of him and he gives the first guy five talents, $10,000. The second one, two talents, $4,000. And the third one, one talent, which is $1,000. By ancient standards, that was an extraordinary amount of money. Now, you may think if somebody gives you $1,000, $2,000, $4,000, or $10,000, that also is an extraordinary amount of money. But even more so then, when people worked for pennies a day, when poverty was the rule rather than the exception, a tremendous amount of money was entrusted to these three servants. Although, to get an idea how rich the master was, when you read down in verses 21 and 23, he says that it was only a little bit of money. He said, if you think that that's a lot, I'm going to entrust you with a whole lot more. So this guy had vast wealth, and he entrusted $10,000, $4,000, and $1,000 worth of it to these, his specially selected servants. Specifically, he did not tell them what his expectation was, only that he entrusted to them his property. In other words, he trusted them to take good care of what was his, to take care of his property as he would take care of his property if he weren't going away on a trip. Now, I read this parable, and with it, I just have all these questions that float up to the surface. I wonder why in the parable they got different amounts, as I wonder why in life people seem to have different distributions. I look at a room full of people like this, and I realize that the same thing is the case here. There are some here who financially have a great deal, and there are others here who have financially very little. There are some here who have, in terms of years, a high degree of education, and there are others who have, by comparison, very little education. There are some who have extraordinary talents, and others have lesser talents. There are some who will live a very long time, and others whose lives will be a small percentage of the longevity of others. All kinds of differences. And I wonder why. I wonder why some seem to have so much and others seem to have so little. From the parable, I can only conclude that the master knew well the abilities of those who were his servants, and he entrusted to them that which he entrusted to them according to that which they were able to handle. So it is with God that to some he gives greater wealth because perhaps they have the ability to handle that greater wealth. And this is maybe a hard truth to realize, that to some he gives problems because he knows that they have the abilities to handle those problems in a way that others could not. What's so amazing, I think, is that God trusts us at all with anything. Don't we often talk about what we trust God to do? So we tell God that we will trust him with our health and with our children and with our jobs and with our money and with our futures, that he is dependable, that he is invariably trustworthy. But seldom do we ever turn it about and think in terms of what God trusts us with. But does he not trust us with a myriad of things? Does he not give to us gifts? And then he expects us to manage those gifts as he would manage them. So to some he has given wealth that they may demonstrate to the world how God would handle wealth. And to others he gives poverty so that they may describe and live out before all the world how God would live in poverty. To some he entrusts marriage, and to others he entrusts singleness. To some he entrusts childlessness, and to others he entrusts children. There are some whom he has entrusted with a handicap, and others whom he has entrusted with health. All different gifts, as different as our names and our ages and everything about us. Different gifts, to be sure, but the same accountability. The issue is not how much or how little we have. The issue is whether or not we handle that which God has entrusted to us as he would handle it, and that he holds us accountable for our actions in that which he has given to us, his servants. In the parable, there is a difference not only in the gifts, but also in the responses to these gifts. And I think that we need to beware of misunderstanding these different responses. Because in initial reading of this parable, one might get the impression that the master is a very greedy and selfish man who only rewards a 100% return on that which he has put out to investment, and who is severely critical of anything that is anywhere less. Therefore, the servants who have 5 and 2 talents and doubled their money are lavishly praised, while the servant who has only 1 talent and who has 0 growth is severely condemned. Indeed, it looks as if the master is a greedy man who only rewards growth, but that misses the point. Terribly misses the single point which this parable is about. You see, the first 2 servants manage the money the way the master would manage the money. And the 3rd servant did not manage the money the way the master would manage the money. Therefore, the 2 are classified as faithful, and the 3rd is classified as faithless because he did not manage the money as he ought. Now, to rightly understand this, I think we need to take the parable, and instead of looking at it as we have been doing straight on, we need to come around about 45 degrees and examine it from another angle, perhaps changing only slightly some of the details that are given. Let's suppose that servant number 1 and servant number 2 invested their talents in the exact same way as described in Matthew 25, but that they lost everything. Not only no return, but lost the capital as well. And let's suppose that servant number 3 buried his talent the same way that he did, and that the changes in the economy appreciated the value of that talent of silver. So instead of being worth $2,000, it was worth far more. What then would be the master's response? I contend that he still would reward servants number one and number two, and he still would have been critical of servant number three, because at issue here was not the return on the money, at least not primarily. At issue here was whether or not these servants functioned as he would have functioned and represented him as he would choose to be represented. Listen to his commendation that he gives to each of the first two servants. He says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." He doesn't even mention the return on the money. He comments on their faithfulness. "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful," twice he mentions it, "over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." Again, what we must remember is that this parable is not about money, but that this parable is about accountability. That Jesus was teaching that we are accountable to God for whatever he entrusts to us. That means that to some, God has entrusted money, more or less. To all of us, God has entrusted time, although admittedly for some the time is short and for others the time is long. To some, there has been the entrusting of position, significant position, in business or church or community. To some, he has entrusted children. To others, leadership abilities. To some, health. To many, truth. He expects us then to faithfully handle that which he has entrusted to us as he would handle it. Plus, he holds us accountable for our actions handling that which he has given to us. Now, there's a simple practical test that we can take. We can look at our money, and we can ask the question, have we, are we, shall we spend it or invest it or save it as God would spend or invest or save it? Or take our time. In this past week, have we used the time 24 hours each day as God would use that time? Is our schedule for this day or for this week now just begun a schedule of the utilization of time that is compatible with what God would want us to do with the time, were he personally managing it right here? Same thing is true with our bodies. Do we take care of our bodies, treat our bodies, whether in terms of exercise or food or medical care or sexual relations or anything else, as he would manage and care for our bodies in any and all of these dimensions? Because you see, actually, our money is his money. He has simply entrusted it to us. Our time is not our time, it is his time. The Bible is very explicit that our bodies are not even our own bodies, but that they belong to him. We are simply servants. We are stewards who must manage then that which he has entrusted to us. And what the parable is saying is that we are held accountable, that we do it his way. Now, related to this accountability for action is also an accountability for our attitudes. And I'm in a bit of a struggle here on how the two interrelate. I'm not sure if we should talk first about actions and then attitudes, or first attitudes and then actions. Actually, the two are so interwoven that they are practically inextricable. They are so much one that it's only a matter of logic on a piece of paper that we can sort out the two, because in real life, the two function together. This accountability for attitudes has to do with what we think about God and how that shows in how we behave toward God. As I read and study this parable, I wonder why servant number three did what he did. I assume that the very fact that he was selected out of all the servants to be one of the three to manage this money says that he was fairly well known to the master and that he knew the master quite well. So there was a familiarity with what would be the master's style and the master's management of money, his strategy as well. Beyond that, I've also got to assume that he knew what was being done with the five talents and the two talents by servant number one and servant number two. He must have. The cities in those days weren't that large. They were investing out in the public marketplace. It just had to be known by everybody. You do know if someone that's a friend of yours or a coworker, a relative, has some money, They may not tell you how much they have or how they invest it, but you know, don't you? Because their in-laws told you, or so there's some other way. We just find out those kinds of things. But the smaller the community and the more public the transactions, the greater the knowledge. Servant number three had to know over a long period of time what servants number one and number two were doing. So he had to know what was the master's style, and he had to know how two-thirds of this group of managers were managing the assets. And yet he behaved in what the master considered to be a totally reprehensible way. Why? Well, it had to do with his attitude toward the master, or the difference in attitudes toward the master. Servants number one and two saw the master as benevolent, as a good man. And because they saw him as benevolent, they figured that they now had a great opportunity. By contrast, servant number three saw the master as malevolent, as a bad guy, and perceived the consequences of mismanagement as oppression that would come against servant number three from the master. The first servants simply knew in their attitude that their master was a good man. And because they perceived him that way, they were thrilled with the opportunity to be his representative. They had watched him for a long time. They saw the way he lived. They saw the way he functioned. They saw the way he handled that which was his, and it was a great deal. So when they had the opportunity to walk in his sandals, to manage his money, it was a thrilling opportunity that was theirs. They were delighted, of course, by the confidence, the trust that he exercised in them. So their attitudes then were based upon the way they perceived the master. They then grabbed hold of the opportunity that was theirs. They had been careful students of the manager, the strategy and the style of their master, and so they welcomed this opportunity to live as he would live and do as he would do. Then the master comes back, and he's delighted. Of course he's delighted, because they did what he would do. They were his kind of people. They had done it his way. There's a sense in which servants number one and servant number one and servant number two had paid to him the ultimate compliment in their attitudes toward him and in their actions on his behalf because they did it his way. And they were successful at it. What a completely different attitude was demonstrated by servant number three. Look at verses 24 and 25 and listen as he describes face to face to the master what he's like. He says, "Master, I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not winnow. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground." Now you've got to understand what he is saying here is not particularly complimentary toward the boss. You think it is. All right, then I want you to try this tomorrow morning. Here, you grab a hold of your bulletin and you write on the back, okay? The first thing you do is go into the boss and say, you can tell him I say, okay? Say, "Boss, you're a hard man. You are one tough cookie. I go to this church where everybody has a nice boss, but not me. You are one hard guy to work for and work with." That's just the first thing, okay? Second thing he says to the master is, "You reap and gather where someone else sowed and winnowed." That is a roundabout way of saying, "You're a thief. Other people do the sowing. Other people winnow. Other people do all the work, put in all the labor and investment, and when it comes to harvest time, you take it." Sort of, you know, building up a rapport with the boss is what this is all about. Then number three, he says, "I'm afraid of you. I and the other employees are scared of you." So he has said, "You're a hard man, you're a thief, and your employees are afraid of you." Hardly a complimentary positive attitude toward the boss. But it was because he had this perception and because he had this attitude toward the master that he behaved as he did. He did not do as the master would have done because he was not a faithful steward. What he did was not what the master wanted, but what he did was based upon his perception of the master and the necessity of preserving his own hide. He was concerned about taking care of himself. We need to note here that because of right and wrong attitudes toward the master, it's really the first two servants who acted responsibly and the third servant who acted recklessly. Now, you wouldn't get that in the first reading of this parable. You'd think that the first two guys were out there speculatively investing somebody else's money and risking the loss. And you would say they were reckless. And you would say that number three was really the responsible party because he at least preserved the capital which had been entrusted to him. But that would be to miss the whole point of the parable. Faithfulness and recklessness were based upon whether or not they did what the master would do. Now, by that measure, servants number one and two were faithful servants indeed because they did what the master would do. And servant number three was disastrously reckless because he had no regard whatsoever for what the master would have done with his own money. The master's response to this wrong attitude is strong indeed. Let's listen again to verses 26 to 30. The master answered servant number three, saying, "You wicked and slothful servant, so you knew that I reap where I have not sowed and gather where I have not winnowed. All right, if that's what you think of me, then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own, at least with interest." And then he turns to the people that are round about, and he says, "All right, take the talent from him and give it to him who has the 10 talents. In other words, if this guy can't manage my money the way I want it managed, then take it away from him and give it to somebody who will manage it the way I want it managed. Simple as that. For to everyone who has will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away." And then verse 30, which is to many a troublesome verse. "And cast the worthless servant," number three, "into the outer darkness. There men will weep and gnash their teeth." Why, that sounds as if Christians who have wrong attitudes and actions in the management of whatever God has entrusted to us will be sent to hell as a consequence. How does that reconcile with what Jesus said in John 5:24? "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life." If Jesus is here saying that citizens of the kingdom, Christians, who mismanage what has been entrusted to them are sent to hell, that seems to flat out contradict what Jesus said in John 5:24, that those who believe in him are eternally secure, that those who believe in him shall not come into judgment. Now, the answer to this comes in something said earlier, that this is a complex parable. And to understand what this verse means, you're going to have to listen and think for a moment. You have to realize that Jesus is speaking here to, initially, a very specific audience. And that parables were often given so that they would be understood by one group of people, but perhaps not understood by those who were his enemies. And counted among his enemies were the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes and the Pharisees were the religious leaders of his day who had been entrusted by God with the Old Testament law and truth and who had horribly mismanaged it. Who had used Old Testament law and truth not as God would have intended it to be used, but for their own purposes, and in the results they had misshapen beyond recognition that which God had originally given. So this 30th verse ending the parable was a clear communication that those scribes and Pharisees who had so mismanaged the Old Testament truth revealed by God were destined to outer darkness, where men gnash their teeth and weep. But what about us? Out of the first century and into 1987, what does this parable say to us? Well, it says that we are accountable. We are accountable to God for our actions and for our attitudes. What then ought we do? Well, we ought to look at what God has given to us. We ought to take inventory. But when we do that, don't do it in a comparative way. Don't say, "She has more, he has less." Don't say, "I'm younger," or "I'm older," or "I'm smarter," or "richer," or "poorer," or whatever the comparisons may be, because that's not the issue at all. The issue is not what we've got, but what we do with what we've got. What we ought to do is have an attitude that sees God's gracious benevolence in whatever he has given to us, even if they are gifts that we would not have chosen in comparison to gifts that others have received. That we see God as the benevolent God that he is, and he has trusted us with whatever we have. And then, having recognized by inventory that which we have recognized it by attitude, the benevolence of the Lord, we ought to reach out and grab the opportunity to take whatever it is, health or sickness, employment or unemployment, poverty or wealth, handicap or whatever it may be, to take that and use it as God would use it and so represent Him and so live for Him, to faithfully do with whatever God has given to us as God would do with it. And then to anticipate that marvelous day when the Master will say to you, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of the Master."